This week in Retronauts, we split the difference between knowing the path and walking the path. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts. And you are jacking in right now to an episode about The Matrix. This episode may or may not really exist, but if you perceive it exists, then yeah, it exists. Anyway, I am your virtual host, Jeremy Parrish, and with me in this very real meat space podcast that is even more post-apocalyptic than The Matrix's universe, we have...
Did you just use the word meat space?
Meat space.
I've never heard that in my life.
Really?
What does that mean? What does that mean?
Like, what do you think it means? There's virtual space and meat space.
And we refer to...
You are made of meat, sir. Oh,
that's what we refer to in the real world in like early 2000s.
I thought maybe it was M-E-E-T, like Friendster or Orkult.
It's
like
where
some place
the snails...
meet up.
It's where the snails who deliver your mail live in meat space.
Sneakernet happens in meat space.
Okay, this is Shane Burlyman Bettenhausen.
Well,
actually, the Burlyman.
The Burlyman?
Yeah.
All right.
Pondering the metaphysics of spoons, Cat Bailey.
Wow. This is Bob Mackey. I took the orange pill for daytime cold relief without drowsiness.
And yes, the Matrix is more than 20 years old now.
25. Wait, no.
No, 20. 1999. 20. Okay, where were you in 1994 that you thought the Matrix was real?
I thought it was even older than
You're thinking of Johnny Mnemonic.
Yeah.
Lawnmower Man.
So this is... not a specific anniversary. I guess we missed the 20th anniversary.
We did miss the 20th anniversary. We were so busy, excited, like reveling in the 20th anniversary of episode one of Star Wars that...
Hey.
Yeah, I know.
Don't get me started on Jar Jar Binks, okay?
You were proclaiming your deep, carnal love for Jar Jar.
The other reason to revisit the Wachowskis' The Matrix is not only is this the 20th anniversary year when we're recording this still, but they did just recently announce a fourth film coming. So all the more reason to revisit this pivotal moment in pop culture.
And The Matrix has been very pivotal. Some ways very good, some ways kind of bad. Like the whole red pill thing. Let's not talk about that.
I mean, but like you can't blame it for that. But I think
Right. But people adopted its lingo.
Right. But I think now 20 years later, we can really look back and see just how deep and powerful the repercussions of this film were.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we are going to talk about the film. That's right. We are also going to talk about the games and about the legacy. I was going to make notes on this episode to kind of outline the conversation, but then I was rewatching The Matrix and I got so into it that I forgot to take notes. we're just going to wing it.
I also imagine you and I are kind of similar age and these two are a little younger. So we probably all have really good memories of how we first experienced this and what it meant to us back in the day too.
I mean, you were like probably in college-ish or we were in high school.
I was in college.
Recently out of college.
Actually, I just finished college too. You're right. It was the year after I finished college.
Yeah. And so I had a full-time job and not a lot of friends, and I kept hearing how cool this movie was.
Pause. Had you watched Bound before this?
No.
Or had you seen
– I knew nothing about the Wachowskis.
Had you seen Assassins? No. Okay. So like
– I was not really super into esoteric film. Art house film. I was very much into like the anime thing at that point.
Well,
like,
I was –
for the past 5 years or so.
I was into the anime, but I was also –
really going into it.
Also into the art house. So I had seen both Assassins. I didn't realize they wrote Assassins when I saw it, which is not an art house film. It's an Antonio Banderas like action movie. It's really good. I recommend it if you haven't seen Assassins. But anyway, that's written by the Wachowskis. And then based on the success of that, they got Bound, which is this kind of like fun, playful, dark, sexy thriller drama that's highly, highly recommended. They got tons of critical buzz. And I remember I rented it on home video based on the buzz and I thought it was fantastic. And then based on that, they got the deal to make this film called The Matrix with a huge budget produced by Joel Silver with Keanu Reeves. And I remember seeing a thing on TV on like either like Entertainment Tonight or 60 Minutes long before The Matrix came out, like while they were filming The Matrix, and about how different this thing was, how all the actors were having to do their own stunts and learn Kung Fu. And I remember the script was written on black paper with red ink and shit.
That sounds difficult.
And how they were making storyboards of the whole movie. So I remember being excited like 6 months before this movie came out, like, oh my God, I can't wait to go see this movie on opening day.
I remember seeing like previews or trailers or something for the movie and thinking, that looks really stupid. I'm not going to watch that. But then the buzz around the movie once it came out was really, really positive. And so I thought, all right.
Did anybody else see it on opening day?
No.
Heck no.
No, I saw it.
I saw
sorry,
like
Kat.
A month later.
Oh, so I saw it on opening day in a full theater at like a midnight screening, and people were fucking super into it and like applauded at the end and cheered, and it was a huge deal.
I thought it was not popular until word of mouth. Is that the story behind it?
Yeah. That's certainly the impression I got. Like it was definitely, I don't know, where I lived, certainly. It was kind of a, you know, like a word of mouth thing.
So I don't think we can talk about The Matrix without referencing the fact that Star Wars The Phantom Menace came out almost at the same time.
It was less than 2 months later.
Yeah. And so I think everybody was full blown into Phantom Menace hype mode at this point.
Well, which is also hard to imagine by modern standards because that was a huge deal.
So yeah. Like just like for reference, the Austin Powers sequel –
Gold member.
Austin Powers 2.
Spy Who Shagged.
Totally references the fact that Phantom Menace is coming out and being like,
the trailer is like, if you only see one movie this summer,
go see
Star Wars.
Whatever.
If you see two movies, see Gold.
Well, it is true. Like, Matrix wasn't expected to be a runaway hit, whereas Star Wars obviously was.
So the first time I heard of The Matrix was through TV commercials, and I saw the bullet time stuff where they're jumping up and doing the wire foo, and I thought to myself, well, that looks really cheesy. And I completely wrote it off. Did not even think about it until like months later when all of my friends were talking about how amazing The Matrix was and how everybody had to see it. And I was like, what? So when I was in high school, I reviewed movies actually for our high school newspaper with a friend of mine. And so we watched The Matrix together. That was my first time watching it. And then I reviewed it.
Quick question. Is it rated R?
No, it's
PG-13. Okay, because for a second I thought maybe it was R for some weird reason. That was like a limiting factor for it. No, it was PG-13.
No, it just wasn't – I don't know. Like it did not have that much buzz around it before it launched because everyone – to put it in context, Star Wars hype, like the hype machine for that had been built slowly and steadily and with great fervor over the course of more than 5 years.
Right.
Like Lucas had a roadmap to episode one that involved, you know, like Shadows of the Empire, like the supplemental content.
Well, and the re-release of the special editions.
The re-releases of the special editions.
Yeah. Well, have you guys ever done a Phantom Menace Retronauts?
No, we haven't gotten there yet.
Well, because like,
we'll get you on that one.
For example, my friends and I camped out for 4 nights for the Phantom Menace.
Oh, man, you were one of those people.
We're one of those people, right? No one did that for The Matrix. It was just, hey, this cool thing we went to go see. Right. There was a huge gulf between the excitement, anticipation for the Phantom Menace, and this come from nowhere,
right.
Never heard of it before movie.
But yeah, Matrix was like, oh, it's Ted Theodore Logan like learning kung fu. That's silly.
So I guess
the movie came out of kind of nowhere for most people,
right.
And was way more successful in their minds.
And this
at least,
was when things could come out of nowhere,
right. But it wasn't like it only found success on home video. It actually hit. It did very well. It only had a $60 million budget, made like $200 million, and it played for a very long time.
Yeah.
So you probably all saw the theater months after it had.
I did not see it in the theater. I saw it on VHS. Yeah.
Oh,
I was lucky enough to see it just a few weeks after it came out because I was as online as I am now, just very online. But I did not even hear anyone talking about it. And my stepdad at the time was a non-traditional college student. He was like getting a degree in his 40s and he was in a writing class and he had to write a movie review. So he's like, I got to see a movie today. The Matrix looks cool. Do you want to see it with me? So I went.
That's a cool stepdad.
It was. Yeah, it was a cool stepdad. And he still is. And I went to see the movie with a friend of mine and my stepdad. And we like didn't hear anything about it before the movie. And then that's all we could talk about after the movie was over. And in fact, the movie was so good that after that screening, a woman was pulled out of that theater on like a gurney. Somebody was hospitalized because The Matrix blew their mind so much.
I mean, this was back in the era where people would go to movies and be like, I don't understand what I just saw. I don't think that happens so much anymore. But I remember that happening with Mission Impossible in 1996. People were like, what was that? What was the plot there? They had to go back and see it again. And Matrix was the same way where people were like, you know, I was – paying so much attention to the cool special effects that I really don't know what just happened. Oh. So they would go back and see it again.
There's a commercial. There's a TV commercial for The Exorcist that is literally just about, like, you're going to lose your shit when you go see this movie in the theater. And just, like, people freaking the fuck out watching The Exorcist.
No one will be admitted after the second act.
It's amazing.
And then – oh, sorry.
If it had come out in 2019, there would have been major social media buzz. And then you would have seen think pieces everywhere. Yeah. And then everybody would have been able to read up on it.
But I'll say, like, you know, as someone who was excited before it came out, like, the first poster for this is just the scrolling backwards green katakana. Like, they were teasing this. There was excitement among, like, cool sci-fi nerds. We knew this was going to be the
Shane setting himself up as the cool one.
No, for real. Like, we knew this was going to be the shit. And it, like, it over-delivered. Like, yeah, I can't think of too many films other than this where we walked out, like, just aghast by how fucking
cool. It was everything I wanted and more.
Yeah, like, I mean, again, like, a major motion picture about cyberpunk, about the internet, that wasn't dumb. Like, have you seen Sandra Bullock in The Net? Mm-hmm. I have.
I've seen her using a laptop on the beach with no
Pizza.net with Dennis Miller.
Yeah, or Job 316. Like, this was made on Usenet.
Right, this was, like, for us, by us, like, in a way that, like, most major sci-fi movies had not been.
Yeah, the thing that makes this movie successful, I think, is that the Wachowskis are nerds. And not just for, like, anime and stuff like that, but for movies.
Yeah.
Like, they're really – you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that this movie came out pretty soon after Metal Gear Solid, because I feel like they are cut in a lot of ways from the same cloth as Hideo Kojima.
It's funny you bring that up, because I think MGS2 is kind of a reaction to this in part.
Yeah, probably.
In many ways.
But I mean – you know, Metal Gear Solid integrates so many, like, movie nerd elements into it. And the Wachowskis are the same way. But they also were like – okay, so Kojima is, like, super influenced by Western movies, you know, American Hollywood films. This was a movie influenced very heavily by anime and by Chinese wuxia. Mm. And it was really – I think – I would argue it's the first American-produced and made movie – that really managed to take those disparate foreign influences, those specific influences, and turn them into something meaningful that's not just like an imitation or satire or like really ham-fisted, but to like kind of understand what is it that makes these things cool? Like, what is it about wire foo that works, and enhance it in new ways? They used digital techniques, but they didn't go full CG animation like Star Wars did. They used computer animation, computer blending and enhancements in smart ways, you know, for color grading and for combining the bullet time effects using actual cameras. It's not just like 3D models of people being rendered in there. They actually, like, when you see the bullet time of Trinity jumping in the air and doing a slow motion kick, they actually have, like, I don't know, like 100 cameras that, you know, like still cameras firing off in sequence.
It's not CG.
And then they use computer graphics, CG technology to blend that and to make it, you know, really convincing.
It's funny that technology was used to make the Matrix and Gap commercials in 1999.
But yeah, that I mean, everyone wanted to do bullet time as soon as they saw that movie. But I think what really makes this movie effective, in the same way that Mad Max Fury Road is effective, is that it's restrained in its use of computer effects and knows that sometimes practical is the way to go. Mm-hmm. And there's this understanding of, like, you know, to make our craft better, we have to know when to use these resources. And they hit it just right. And there are definitely parts of this movie that, you know, going back to watch it again, I was like, whoa, those full CG parts of the fields of batteries and, like, robots and stuff, that looks pretty bad now. But everything else, like the actual live character effects, it still works really well. It looks so much more convincing than a lot of modern films.
And Phantom Menace was billed as the greatest special effects extravaganza of its time, right? And I would say that Matrix holds up way the heck better than Phantom Menace. I don't think that's like a controversial thing to say. And I think a lot of that is what you had to say. And also, it wasn't as cartoony as Phantom Menace. That certainly helped. They did it. I watch it now, honestly. The last time I watched The Matrix was in a plane, actually, which isn't the greatest place to watch it. But
small screen.
But I was like, wow, man, this movie has an energy to it. It has a style to it. It still works for me.
It's funny, Jeremy, you bring up the CG stuff, because I was recently thinking about this, how like now, you know, 20 years after this, we're so used to computer generated imagery. But like, you know, 20 years ago, it was still new for it not to stick out, for it not to be Lawnmower Man, for it not to be like garish, hideous, obviously not real. And by the time of Phantom Menace and The Matrix, you could kind of like interpolate it in a way where like it actually like meshed with what you were looking at and was cohesive. And I feel like revisiting this film, like for me, the CG mostly did work. It didn't look amateurish and
not
shitty.
Until Matrix Reloaded did it start to look
right,
amateurish.
Yeah, we'll get to the Burly Raw, how bad it looks. But like I think more importantly, what Jeremy was getting to with like how this film narratively synthesizes Star Wars, anime, like, you know, kind of like these different – like a lot of
wuxia,
different
so much
yeah
wuxia.
And like yeah like kung fu cinema, you're right, like traditional Hong Kong kung fu cinema, like in a way to make something new that then has been copied so much since this, like that specific combination that this thing mastered worked and like be kind of like was like, you know, inspired a whole new part of pop culture that now 20 years ago is now commonplace, like The Matrix, Bullet Time. It's like, you know, all these things that were new and fresh when you saw them in 1999 are now just completely rote.
Okay, so one thing that I think we have to address is the fact that they cast Keanu Reeves as the protagonist of this cyberpunk thriller. Keanu Reeves had already been in Johnny Mnemonic. Yeah. So I think that might have been kind of a little bit of a, I don't know about this. Like I actually – my first perception of this was like, is this like a sequel to Johnny Mnemonic?
But like that film was considered kind of like not great by a lot of people. It was like too heady. Like I mean as successful as Johnny Mnemonic was, like I feel like it didn't quite deliver what everyone wanted it to, and it wasn't a giant success.
I believe Will Smith turned this role down.
He did, and yeah. he has since gone on the record and said, you know what? I would have messed up this movie. I'm so glad it went to Keanu Reeves because he did it justice and yeah. I wouldn't have gotten it.
You need his doofy coolness.
And both Keanu and Lawrence Fishburne were big names, cool actors who were draws.
I think Keanu Reeves' star was a little bit on the wane, you know, like the post-Speed era.
Right.
And he was starting to move into more like kind of smaller roles or – you know, romantic comedies, like, what was it? Something's Gotta Give, that kind of thing. And that came later, but he was kind of moving in that direction.
But whenever he tried to do something that wasn't in his wheelhouse, it wasn't so good.
Like Dracula?
My Own Private Idaho?
No, he's actually good at My Own Private Idaho, but like, what's the one where he like inherits a vineyard? Oh, it's real bad. Anyway.
If Will Smith had been cast as Neo, he would have totally taken over that film, being Will Smith.
Yeah.
His reactions would have been really over the top versus Keanu Reeves's much more subdued kind of...
And he kind of sleepwalks through it, but...
But at the same time, he's the audience insert, right, into the film. So you're looking at this world through his eyes. So the fact that he's kind of in the background is sort of okay because you are in this world.
Although I'll say the film opens with Trinity, with Carrie Ann Moss, who was relatively unknown. She was
well-known actress.
Yeah, she'd done some supporting roles. But like I remember thinking she in some ways stole the film from me when I first saw it.
Yeah, and Lawrence Fishburne had been in, was it Do the Right Thing? He was the dad?
Also, like, you know, Apocalypse Now.
I didn't realize he was in that.
Oh, he's 15.
He was like a child.
He's 15. Okay. He's credited as Larry Fishburne.
Pee-wee's Playhouse? Come on.
He'd been in lots.
Give it up.
Yeah, he'd actually done a lot of work, but not anything like this. Yeah.
Well, one thing we haven't mentioned is that I've read about the marketing campaign, even though, like, I only saw the ads. And they really set it up to be like, what is The Matrix? Like they set up
That was the tagline. What is The Matrix?
They set up the mystery of what The Matrix is from the beginning of the marketing campaign, and that was what was supposed to draw you in.
Well, and the movie plays on that because it takes like half an hour for you to actually find out what The Matrix is, and Neo has to really commit to it. Thomas Anderson has to really commit to it. And like, okay, can we talk about the symbolism in the names Thomas Anderson, Doubting Thomas, also Son of Man? So they were really playing it up, not being very subtle here.
I think it's also important for our younger listeners to think about in 1999, the average American person was not really on the internet much. Like we were all young and
we had already dissected Evangelion, so we were cool
right,
and
like,
we knew.
You know, we were like people, I think everyone here had been on Usenet or IRC.
I had my pages, yeah.
Like we were, you know, we were – of that generation.
I was extremely online by 99 standards. A lot of people I knew didn't even have computers in 1999.
Yeah. Most people didn't have cell phones. Most people didn't have email addresses. Like, the internet was still new. So, like, this film is, you know, was prescient in many
ways. 1994 was considered, like, the great wave in which when AOL, I think, went public.
Right.
And then after that, it built up steadily. But still, 1999, we're still on barely 56K modems.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so much has changed.
So the internet was still cool back in 1999.
1999 was the launch of the first games console that had a modem built in.
Right. The idea of a hacker was still kind of this, like, mysterious concept for the average consumer. Like, what is that? What did they do?
Yeah. I mean, we had seen the movie Hackers, but that was not accurate.
Hack the planet!
So, The Matrix. What is The Matrix? Let's talk about the movie itself and the premise.
Well, it turns humans into electric potatoes.
Yes, basically. So,
well, imagine the machines become self-aware, kind of Terminator
style. You have to get over the ridiculousness of the core premise of The Matrix, which is that somehow it is, like, thermodynamically efficient to use human beings, extremely complex apex predator, top of the food chain objects, like living beings, as batteries to power a giant computer.
They should be cows.
That's very
simple. Number one.
Well,
yes.
The idea that the machines have become self-aware and they are harvesting their energy from the humans that created them.
Well, I think that they had a somewhat more complex idea around why the humans were being made, like for something like the brain was being used as processing
power.
Yeah,
basically, like, we were all being used as, like, multi-core processors.
Right.
Our brains were a core each in this massive computing complex.
Oh, it's like the cell it's like the cell processor.
Yeah, but the studio execs, I guess, were like, nobody understands what the heck you're talking about. Make them batteries.
Well, and so while people are being sucked of their life juice, then they're in their minds, they're living out their mundane, normal lives, aka our existence, our plane of reality.
So, well, the premise, peak of human society,
yes,
1999.
Which, actually, yes.
I have things to say about that. So I'm doing a lot of podcasts for my other podcasts, Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon, and Talking Futurama and things like that. We're doing a lot of things in 1999 for some reason around this time. And we keep mentioning the end of history period of America, where it was like we were living in a cozy neoliberal bubble where it was understood that nothing bad would happen to us. And like the torch would be passed from Clinton to Gore and then whatever other Democrats into the, you know, impossible future. And I think at this point, like, we had to create our own problems because they just weren't a factor in our lives. And this is like a huge movie because of that. Just like, what if bad things were happening and we had no control over our lives? Well, now we're just like, it's understood that we don't. And bad things always happen.
And we're all always online.
Yes.
There's no escape.
Yep.
But yeah, the Matrix is a computer simulation in which the humans of this world have been trapped by sentient machines that conquered humanity. It's like Shane said, kind of like the Terminator, except that instead of being skeletal Arnold Schwarzeneggers, they're basically like giant squid bots. And they treat us as batteries.
They're kind of like the Quintessons.
Yeah, a little bit, except they don't have the five faces and pass judgment on everyone.
I got to say that I like the entire sequence where he's explaining it, where they're sitting in the white room watching an old style TV. And it doesn't look dated. It looks kind of retro, intentionally retro.
Well, I mean, even then, that television was very retro.
Yes.
But I do like when you get into the real world and you've got like Sony PVM monitors all over the place. It's like, wow, that's some nice gear. I'd love to get my hands on that stuff now.
Well, it's funny you brought up Hackers, because I say, unlike Hackers, like the presentation what is the Matrix, the real world that our hacker friend lives in and the party he's going to, it all does seem kind of cool, still holds up. It does, like at the time, it didn't seem cheesy at all.
Now we know what hackers look like and what their lives are like.
Yeah, right? It's they get the fact that Neo is extremely pale, right? But that's about it.
And also our real world, they do a lot with lighting.
Mm-hmm.
So the real world is kind of has this green tinge to it.
It's color
filtered, yeah.
Well, world.
The real world is kind of blue cast and the Matrix world is green.
Green.
Yeah,
so everything
WB
is
logo.
Blue cast now.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But at the time, Yeah, so
it had a very distinct visual look.
Yes.
Yeah, and again, I mentioned Metal Gear Solid earlier, and Metal Gear Solid was the first game I can think of that had color grading also.
Well, and the, you know, reduce color palette to make better performance.
Yeah. Well, not just better performance, but to create a consistent look and style. And like that became much more pervasive after The Matrix, but you really didn't see it that often. And well, it, you know, it's a computer processing technique, so it was kind of a new, again, a use of CG that wasn't like, here is a, you know, like a clownish reptile man. It's like here's a way to kind of create a subtle visual distinction between two alternate spaces.
The opening bits are really good. Just like I really like how they're slowly setting it up. So many movies now are really in a hurry to get to the point. This one is much more of a slow burn.
Yeah.
There's the whole bit where he's in the office and the agents come looking for him and he's trying to hide and everything. And I think Trinity is kind of directing him.
Morpheus.
He gets caught and there's that horrific thing with the thing that goes inside his belly button.
And he has no mouth, but he must scream.
Yeah, it's kind the
of,
bug.
Kind of some Cronenberg style body horror there, which I like. Well, and I like, you're right. It takes a long time before the viewer and, you know, Neo are both kind of introduced to the great secret show that's really happening. And then like when you do find out what's really happening, you're kind of, you know, in media res, like there's this crew, there's all these things happening, there's all these characters, there's so much going on. There's this whole universe that you feel like has really been occurring.
It's kind of got a like a Wizard of Oz element to it where it seems like one world is real but then you experience like another world and everything's different.
Right.
Except that instead of going to a cool fantasy world, Neo is actually taken out of the cool fantasy world and shown the gross, horrible, depressing real world where everyone just eats porridge and they wear very clearly smelly clothing with holes in them.
Right.
And they're living in like basically sewer tunnels and spaceships.
Yeah, and you hear about like the one city Zion where the humans live. But yeah, like as if like it's like, oh, this was a fantasy and the reality is bleak and horrible and it's been going on for a long time.
What's the name of one of the key villains?
Cypher.
Like you can understand
why he wants
to go back.
Yeah. You can understand why he would betray them.
Oh, yeah. I want Illusion World.
Yeah. You would abhor his motives in betraying everybody, but at the same time, you understand.
Give me a simulation of happiness.
I think somebody said when he goes, I want to come back, maybe as an actor, I don't want to remember anything. People are suggesting that he was alluding to the fact that he wants to be Ronald Reagan.
Well, it's funny. I don't think there's been a Retronauts on AI. There probably never will be. So I'm going to bring a similar film.
Came out Spielberg's movie?
A few years later. But again, like the idea of like, oh, a simulation of happiness is better than the bleak reality is how that film ends, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's one of the core themes of the film is do you want to be in the real world and deal with all the crap or do you want to just fall into the illusion?
Right.
Like one of the first things they say is, look at all these people. They're sheep. They don't want to wake up. If you woke them up, you'd break their brain.
Yeah, and actually, I don't know how much we're going to talk about The Matrix Online, but you know, there were factions within The Matrix Online, the MMO based on the series, which is a continuation of the movie story. And there's an entire faction of blue pillars who just want to, you know, having had The Matrix disrupted and being brought into the real world unexpectedly, all they want is just to go back into the machine. So they're like on the machine's side so they can be reinserted into the Matrix.
It's a bleak outlook.
Yep. But, you know, on the other hand, like, can you kind of blame them?
I'm in the blue man group.
So when I was in high school, I was in a very conservative neighborhood and I knew a lot of born-again Christians and Baptists. And they really played up the religious aspect of The Matrix. They they basically said Neo's Jesus.
I mean, sure, there's Zion the city, Morpheus the god. Oh,
I mean, well, by the end of the third film, he's literally crucified.
What did they have to say about Trinity? What does that mean? Is she God and the Son and the Holy Spirit all at once?
It's kind of a mystery. I don't know.
What do they think about the Matrix as a metaphor for coming out as transgender?
Interesting. Well, I don't think
Christian friends have anything to say about
that. People didn't really think about I guess transgender in 1999, certainly
not a lot of awareness for it.
No. Jeremy, you didn't randomly bring that up. I mean, both of the Wachowskis
Both of the Wachowskis are transgender,
right.
Yes.
And, you know, I read
– and, in fact, they were going to have a character who was trans.
Right, in different in the – who identified as a different gender.
Well, I mean, you have a very androgynous character named Switch. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. So. Well, and it was in the – I was on the Wikipedia page, but there was a good quote from Lana about, like, oh, revisiting the first Matrix with that – from that perspective. And like the part about like the knowledge that Neo has, that like the splinter in the mind's eye of always knowing that something was wrong, of always knowing like that he felt wrong,
like,
about
yeah,
reality.
Dysmorphia, basically.
Yeah, I felt like that was kind of, you know, maybe early
dysphoria.
Dysphoria, yeah, like body dysmorphia.
Because the whole cottage industry to spring into being, where it was like a thousand books called like The Matrix and Philosophy, The Matrix and Religion, and everyone had like the cool college professor where you would watch The Matrix and write a paper about it, because I think it is sort of like a Rorschach test, because it applies like the broadest themes of storytelling and uses like all of this very powerful symbolism, so you can kind of see what you want to see in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's deeply about identity and reality and, yeah, perception. You know, I think the fact that The Matrix has a lot to say and deep things to kind of topics to jump into was a cool thing, because that wasn't something you expected from popcorn, you know, blockbuster AAA cinema.
Yeah, I mean, before we encountered drugs for the first time, my teenage friends and I would be like, what even is reality? Like, are we even doing this right now? Are we like – yeah, it just caused all of those very high conversations to happen.
But there are a lot of things about The Matrix that at the same time, if you watch it now, you kind of go, woo. Like the entire scene – with the when they go through the metal detector.
At the time, that was cool for about a month, and then all of a sudden it was very not cool.
It was very cool it was very cool when the movie came out, and then Columbine happened.
Yeah, it was.
And
the movie came out in March 1999.
Yes.
Columbine happened like 4 weeks later, and all of a sudden everyone was like, let's
Trenchcoat Mafia.
Take a step back. And Columbine was not influenced by The Matrix. That was something that had been those guys had planned that for a long time.
Weren't they more influenced by Natural Born Killers?
I believe so, yeah. And, you know, they made practice levels in Doom and that sort of thing.
I mean, that said, Matrix is kind of gun porny more. You know, like, that's one of the things going back to it. It's like,
yeah,
it's a bit much.
Yeah. Like, yeah, there's the kind of the question of like, so if you die in the Matrix, then you die in real life. So are these like human police that they're killing, or are they constructs? Because I'm pretty sure that they're meant to be like –
no, people. They're totally killing people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I do feel like a lot of the gunplay is an homage to John Woo and The Killer and Hard Boiled.
It is. You know. And he was very much kind of in the Hollywood zeitgeist at the time. This came out around the same time as Mission Impossible 2.
Which is so bad.
It is the worst. I mean, love that series, but that
Tom
is garbage.
When Tom Cruise walks out of the church in slow motion with the fucking doves.
I mean, I you know, the original idea behind the Mission Impossible movie series was that it would be auteur, and each entry would be directed by a different director. And they would put their fingerprint on it. And I really feel like that died after Mission Impossible 2. They were like, actually, maybe this isn't such a good idea. Let's just kind of make some good action movies.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, the gun porn element is a little hard to watch now. And not because of Columbine, just because of like this whole culture has kind of really calcified in America at this point. And
well, and it's also like kind of the least interesting aspect, and one that's really downplayed in the two sequels too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the parts where, you know, Neo is dodging bullets like at superhuman speeds, that's interesting.
That's cool.
When he's able to stop a hail of bullets just by looking at them and putting his hand out, that's interesting. But when they're just like gunning down random dudes.
Yeah, that 5 minute shootout is a little long.
It's most interesting.
Especially
the soundtrack doesn't quite hold up.
The most interesting bits are when he's being chased by the agents and he knows that he can't beat them. So he's just trying to get away, and the agents are just everywhere. Well, they're constantly popping up.
Let's talk about Agent Smith. I mean, he's a cool character.
Well, just the agents, yes. Hugo Weaving is one of the
– He's
great.
He is right up there with Lawrence Fishburne and I guess Keanu Reeves and Carrie Ann Moss as
he's one of the great villains in cinema history.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about people – if you say Mr. Anderson, people will know who
Anderson.
You're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, he
did make his career.
He does chew up the scenery a little bit. But it works.
No, but it works.
It
but
works.
This is a movie that demands it.
Yeah.
I love how they take the idea of like, you know, the men in black, like government agents, and just kind of push them to the point that like there's subtle ways to know like these guys aren't normal. They're not human. They've always got the earpiece. They look like Secret Service. But at the same time, they also like they button all their buttons on their jacket. Like you don't do that. It's just like little tells
they don't
like that.
Seem
where
quite
like,
human.
It also helps that Hugo even is burying that New Zealand accent, so it does sound like very artificial and weird.
Well, and also he's just got kind of like a weirdly shaped head.
Yeah,
and like this mouth that I don't know, like the way he grimaces. It's almost cartoonish, and it just seems like kind of a parody of a human. And I realize I'm saying like Hugo Weaving does not look human. And I apologize for that, Hugo. I think you're a great actor.
I'm sure he's a big fan.
But you like really nailed this by just being so uncanny.
You can tell that he's still in the in the agent mindset when he's doing Fellowship of the Ring because he's like Frodo Baggins.
He seems more sinister than he should.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Mr. Baggins.
It takes.
I'm speaking with an American accent.
Well, and I guess to go back to Keanu too, I think he's really good in this. Actually, I mean, Keanu Reeves, as you said earlier, isn't always good, and he is good in this film.
Yeah, he downplays moments that I think someone like Will Smith would have really hammed up, like when he's like, "No way." It's not like a freak out or anything. He's just like – he's just kind of overwhelmed.
Or I know kung fu.
Yeah, he's so matter of fact about it. It's just like he's always kind of –
but there's like a self-effacing thing that –
dumbfounded
by. Will Smith would have been like bravado and you don't get that so much from Neo in the first film.
And you need that for him because the whole point of the – like his whole arc is, you know, he is doubting Thomas. He keeps being told by everyone
that he is the
Messiah, that he is a god.
He's like, I'm not the
one.
And
he's like – no, he needs that humility, that element of like, I'm just a dude. What is going on here?
And then, of course, his entire arc is eventually learning to accept that. And there is still a very cool metaphysical aspect of being able to understand on a higher level that the world around you, that you can see the matrix. You can see the numbers and then
see
at
the
that
world
moment.
For what it is.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And then from that moment on, he can do whatever he wants. And the agents work really well in that context because they're invincible for the entire movie. They're terrifying. There's a real video game aspect of it.
Oh, yeah.
They're just like NPCs, infinitely replenishable.
Or they're like Mr. X from Resident Evil where maybe you can damage them. Maybe you can take them down for a bit, but they're always going to keep coming back.
Well, around the same time, you had games like Omicron, The Nomad Soul, and Oddworld coming out where the protagonist had the ability to possess characters around them.
You missed
and
Messiah.
That's
Shiny. Speaking of Shiny.
That's right. So you have like these games where one of the protagonist's core powers is the ability to take over villains or project themselves into other characters. And here the villains have that ability and you realize like, wow, it's kind of flipping the tables on the way video games work and you're super overpowered.
And it's done in a really great visual way where suddenly their face starts to distort and they're like, ah, and then they turn into the agent. I'm actually playing a lot of FIFA right now. And you'll be
so it's like dribbling, one of those glitches.
You'll be dribbling the ball, and you'll see an AI player kind of following you, and then you can see the moment when the other player switches over to them, and then they'll start like moving really
it's very
erratically.
Agent Smith.
It's very Matrix.
No one deserves that much power. I will tax the agents.
Joe Biden thinks the agents will have a change of heart after he becomes
we need to work
the
with
one.
The, work with the good agents, reach across the aisle.
Let's jack back into the Matrix.
The 90s was the era of bipartisanship, by the way.
Oh, it totally was.
It all works.
They fetishized it with George W. Bush. He was like, I'm a uniter, not a divider.
And Obama.
I never bought that.
I think this film is more of the aughts than the 90s, though. But
you think so?
I do.
I think it's so 1999. Like, and maybe that's just the mentality. Maybe it's because it's in a very specific moment where anime is really taking off and video games have crossed into us.
I think anime was
a different level.
I think anime was nascent. I think it was pre-millennial.
I don't think so. Evangelion
Ghost in the Shell had already come out, had been in theaters. It was thumbs up from Roger Ebert.
Okay,
and
you're
this movie is so Ghost in the Shell. I mean, when they do the jumps and smashes up
the
pavement.
This is
come
the after effect of
I think
like
you're underestimating the impact that Pokemon had.
I mean, the backward green letters in katakana, like that is Ghost in the Shell.
Well, I will say anime was known but still unknown enough that you could rip it off.
Right.
The premise of Matrix is that anime is real, it
T-Frog.
Is strong, and it is my friend.
T-Frog, right after seeing the premiere of The Matrix in 1999, I had to go to Suncoast to buy like two episodes of Round 1 Half for $39.99 subtitled. It was not your Crunchyroll world you live in now.
You were still buying Ranma 1/2 in 1999?
I was.
You madman.
I was watching.
It stopped getting good after 1997.
Yeah,
you'd moved on to Maison and Koku because you're that like classy.
that was manga only for me.
Oh, the anime's pretty good.
Is it okay? So didn't they get rid of like
they simplified it.
Yeah, they got rid of the Cloud Cuckoo Lander kid, the airheaded kid.
It's all about Kimiguri Orange Road.
Oh, yeah.
That's on my pile of stuff to watch after Gundam.
No, it's funny. We're talking about anime now. But like the last time we taped is Summer of Anime and Kimiguri Orange Road.
No,
Orange
now
Road,
it's Gundam.
Gundam. But Kimiguri Orange Road TV opening is like one of the best 2 minutes of your life.
Yes.
Just watch the opening.
I saw that recently probably on Tumblr and I was like, this is amazing.
Like literally perfect editing.
It's truly, truly amazing.
All right, back to
this
the Matrix.
This has nothing to do with The Matrix, though.
Back to The Matrix.
But it kind of does because, like, this was all in the zeitgeist and people as nerdy as the Wachowskis were totally tuned in.
So tuned in.
And they were processing it and they were translating it into Hollywood in a smart and effective way.
When rewatching this film, I was thinking about it from the anime perspective. And, like, specifically for me, the crew of the ship and the relationship between Neo, who warps into
this
place.
They're Nakama.
Yeah, it is totally the most space opera shit ever.
I love it. Yes, it's the Nebuchadnezzar.
Yep,
which is a great name.
Another biblical reference.
Yes, and okay. So
who's the bright Noah of the Nebuchadnezzar?
Tank.
The bright Noah. I mean,
I guess it's not applicable.
I mean, so you have the operators, right? So that would be like the operators who are
right
guiding the giant robots, and then you have the kid. Who's also the tech genius? Who's working in the hangar? And then you have the captain who's seen a lot.
That's Morpheus.
That would be Morpheus.
He's wise, and he's so wise and so powerful. They have to take him out of the story for a while because he's kind of just to level the playing field, basically.
And you have the love interest, and then you have a bunch of secondary characters who die.
we cannot just. Just reduce Trinity to love interest.
Oh, I know,
she's
but you can also
such a better character.
You also can't just reduce Sailor Mass to love interest, but she's.
That's a good comparison, actually. The thing about Trinity is she's so strong and so just like when people talk about strong female protagonists, it's always kind of like, I don't know, you kind of have a hard time buying it. But she is like she's flinty. She has self-determination. When Neo tries to be like, "Oh, you stay out of the way," she's like, "No, you're not keeping me out of this." She has a cute haircut. She's gorgeous. And
Shane just sighed.
Wearing like all leather. Like okay. She looks great. Okay, let's get that out of the way.
We've only been talking about The Matrix, but one of my problems revisiting The Matrix is I'm still so salty about. How Trinity goes out in the Matrix Revolutions.
It's going to be in Matrix 4, so clearly something's happening there.
Well, I don't think there is a Matrix Revolutions. I think there's only a Matrix.
Yeah, Kat doesn't believe that there's 2 and 3. But no, there are 2
more. I do not subscribe to 2 and 3. That there is a large number of people who do for some reason.
Right.
But I think that they're just
I think Trinity gets done dirty at the end of Revolutions. But in the first film, she has more agency than Neo.
She's like her own agent. No, she is a great character. I'm just saying like
– But she's also
I know,
there
Kat, you're not
to
trying
be
to diminish her by
with.
Calling her the love interest. But yeah, I mean she is definitely – she serves that role.
Doesn't
but she's
she
also an
instant.
In the end, she does fall in love with Neo.
She does.
And brings him back to life with a kiss.
Okay, that's all true. But she seems out of his league.
A kiss of true love.
Right. But initially, she seems out of his league.
Yes. Yeah. The nerd is going, oh my god, the cute Autumn Lee girl is totally into me.
Yeah, she's almost movie. She has kind of this like domineering kind of sex, you know, like she's wearing skin tight leather, like there's yeah.
She's very self-confident. I mean, she like in the club scene, she holds all the cards and Neo's like so out of his depth.
Right.
He's like, what
she's
is happening?
She's definitely at no point is she the damsel in distress in this film.
So you're looking at Neo from the perspective of
Morpheus,
the nerd who
Morpheus
is looking
is
at
the
cool the
one
cool
who's abducted.
Gal.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Morpheus, like the leader, the guy who knows everything, he's the man with a plan. He's the one who's abducted. It's not.
Right.
It doesn't
yeah,
revert
game,
to the like damsel's distress.
Thank God.
Thank God.
Yeah.
This film actually does subvert so many tropes of what you would expect from a traditional sci-fi or fantasy narrative.
And there's that great moment where she calls it. She's like, "Oh, I need to fly a helicopter." Calls in, gets the information beamed into her head. She's like, "All right, I can fly a helicopter."
That was
now.
Super clever. Yeah. Yeah.
I think another movie, this character Trinity would be like in a James Bond movie, be the femme fatale who would get killed or sexually conquered by Bond, or be the femme fatale who would just be murdered. You know, like the female villain. Because she has power, she has to be murdered.
But here, even her falling in love with Neo is empowering to him. It's the thing, it's the thing that pushes him over the edge to make him realize, like, I have to step up and I have to accept, you know, what everyone's been telling me about myself, that I do have these powers, that I do have these abilities, because I need to, you know, like I need to, I guess, live up to the potential we have here.
And the dating pool is very shallow.
It's not.
In that
it's
world.
Not like he steps up to her. Yes.
No, but she pushes.
It's not
him,
like yeah.
She
it's not like
him to be better.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not like he's like I've got to save her and you know accept my power. It's more like I have to accept what she believes in about me.
And on the tip of this being an anime spaceship, they really do a great job of making the Nebuchadnezzar feel like a real place, especially at the final set piece in the film. Where Neo is inside the Matrix and the robots are cutting in. And it's a really intense sequence because when it's all over, you literally see them right there.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say it's a bit like Alien. I mean, there's not an alien on this ship, but in the same like kind of claustrophobic, you're in this enclosed space, you care about the ship itself and the crew, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, everyone kind of has their own spaces, but it's really a lot of public spaces, like shared spaces. And one of the things that I didn't catch my first time through the movie, obviously, but that you notice on the a repeat viewing is when Cypher is talking to the agent and he's in kind of like the computer bank room and he thinks he's alone and Neo walks up behind him and he has like this, oh shit, they just caught me moment. But Neo doesn't know how to read the Matrix yet. So he's like got this, you know, basically betrayal of the entire ship just out in front of him on these screens, unaware that Neo is behind him. And he freaks out for a second, but then he realizes like, oh, Neo doesn't actually know what's happening.
I do remember on my first viewing on opening day, figuring out the Cypher was going to betray them, though. I think it is a little telegraphed. You know, it's not a huge shock.
He has dinner with an agent and is like, take me back into the Matrix.
Right.
it's not just telegraphed. It's like,
at stake.
It's going to happen. Here's Judas.
But then the movie really kicks into high gear when they go on the mission and Cypher's going to betray them. And all the ways – all the ways that they played with the Matrix is so cool. Like
the deja vu
moment, the way
walls.
That suddenly there will be walls around them. And they're like, crap. And he can pull out two giant guns. Mouse can pull out two giant guns. But they ultimately can't do anything. He's totally taken out. And then it cuts back to the real world. And he's just like shaking and then he's gone. And poor Tank. And then the moment when Cypher is like unplugging them. And that's a really creepy sequence right there when Switch is going, no, not like this. No. Oh, my God. And then boom, she's gone.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Jeez, that's an effed up scene even now.
It's
a great movie. And then it just feels like the movie never stops to catch its breath after that. It just keeps going and going and going.
Yeah. It really feels like, it takes its time to build up. But then once it gets to the point where it's like the point of no return, it's over. But we do need to talk about the sequels. And Shane, you were actually in one of the sequels.
So you were actually in a sequel.
Yeah. I mean, like, the short version of this is between The Matrix coming out and the launch of the sequel, Matrix Reloaded, which was what, 3 years later? How many years?
2003?
2002.
Three years later.
I had moved to California to follow my dreams to become a games journalist. My first job was at gamers.com. I worked with lots of cool people out there.
Did you meet Thresh.
I got Thresh. I sat in his Ferrari. I worked with people like John Riccardi and Mark McDonald and
the real celebrities.
Christian Nutt and all sorts of celebs. Anyway, then we all got laid off. And then when we all got laid off, we were destitute here in the Bay Area where it's very expensive.
Was it very expensive even during the dot-com crash?
This was 20 years ago. It was still very expensive. And so we didn't know what to do. And a few of us applied. My friend Chris Leonard, we didn't have texting. Do we have texting? No, he probably like emailed me. He was like, hey, apparently they're going to film part of the second Matrix movie here in the Bay Area. We should sign up to become extras so we could be in this movie. And it costs like $100 to go get headshots made at a talent agency. But we did it.
Hmm.
And we submitted our headshots. And a few of us, Chris and I, got called back by the casting agency. And so we became background actors in The Matrix Reloaded. We weren't hired for the project called Matrix Reloaded. The code name was called The Burly Man. And we would drive
out to –
What's
the name of the Wachowskis production company?
It is, yeah. And The Burly Brawl is the code name for like the big fight against all the agents. Anyway, so for
– It's just one agent.
For 2.5 months, we would drive out to Alameda and on the old disused Army base. Or was it a Naval base?
Oh, yeah. Navy.
Oh, is that where it was filmed? I thought it was filmed in L.A.
No, Wait a minute. They filmed it in Alameda?
They filmed it in Alameda.
Okay, yeah, there is that Army base. It takes up a huge amount of space.
Yeah, there's a disused Army base on Alameda where they built the freeway. And for 2.5 months, not every day, you would wait until the night before and you'd call in to this number to find out if you had to show up the next day.
It's like jury duty.
Yeah, it's like jury duty.
Pretty much.
So over the course of 2.5 months, I probably ended up doing like, I don't know, 30 or 40 days total as a background driver and for a week as a specialty extra. I got upgraded. And it was amazing. Like you always imagine, what is it like to make movies? It was lots of downtime, lots of waiting around, but also like meeting cool people, eating delicious food, seeing crazy stunts. Like, and I was driving my own car, I had a Mitsubishi Mirage. It's gray. And like people are like, okay, can you see me in the movie? I'm like, well, no, only if you like zoom in and pause it.
Wait, so you were driving your own – personal car?
My own car, yeah.
So if we get the Blu-ray, we can zoom in and see Shane's
old car. It's pretty hard to find
it. We need the 4K master.
Right. But yeah, you would bring your own car. And then like there'd be the stunt drivers who had stunt cars and they were the ones who were doing all the stunts. And we weren't doing stunts.
So anyway, you were just like fodder basically.
Right. We were basically driving around and like most days were kind of boring. But then like the days when giant things were happening, obviously like there's that huge chase scene that's 30 minutes in the middle of The Matrix Reloaded. That's what we were filming. And there's parts where like the semis are crashing into each other and exploding. And like the days when there were effects, that was crazy to watch. And it was like 6 hours of preparing for one shot because the effects had to go and like things had to hit each other and the stunt drivers had to drive through. And it was super cool. The whole experience was neat. And like a few memories I had were like one day we were eating lunch at Craft Services. Somebody had left a huge storyboard sitting there. And like what I read about is they had hired for both Matrix and the sequels like two comics guys, Jeff Darrow and someone else, to like make storyboards of the entire script, right? So like we found like this giant binder which had like drawn storyboards of the entire film in it, which we were just going through. It was like super cool. And we got to meet, you know, most of the stunt doubles for the main people like Trinity and Neo and Morpheus. They were super cool.
They did their own stunts.
You think that. They did some of their own stunts, but not on the motorcycle.
Keanu knows Kung Fu now.
Well, not, on the motorcycles, they didn't do their own
stunts. Yeah, Moss got injured during the Matrix
Reloaded.
Yeah, she did get
injured. So. But yeah, it was super – it was really interesting and like I look back on it very fondly. But I always remember as we were filming the chase on the freeway, the first assistant director and second assistant director, we never worked with the Wachowskis directly. They would tell us that like, oh, when the movie comes out, there'll be like a city. You'll see like all these finished effects. And so I remember going and seeing the film in the theater on the day it came out and being like, oh, there is no like city. Like it just kind of looks like what it really looks like. When you watch that chase sequence, like that's just kind of what it looks like at Alameda. Like they didn't CG like a giant city into the background or anything.
Hmm.
So I always felt like, oh, did they just like run out of time? Like
that's so weird because I live in Alameda.
Right. Yeah. So every time I go to Alameda, it's really weird.
Now like, the Army base is full of distilleries and
Last year I went to a music festival out there. They moved the Treasure Island Festival to that place. And I was like, oh, weird. This is where we filmed The Matrix Reloaded. So yeah, I look back on it very fondly. And then I wanted to be in the Zion dance sequence.
Oh, my God.
Doing E.
That was the best sequence.
So that was a separate casting call.
That was when I used my bathroom break.
Right. So that was a separate casting call.
You could have been part of the orgy.
Except I couldn't, because when that casting call got posted, it said, sorry, no Caucasians.
Mm. Oh.
Wow.
Reverse racism strikes again. It's a real problem.
I thought was pretty interesting. And if you go back and watch that sequence, it would be like, yep, no Caucasians.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Shane in the Matrix Reloaded.
That's probably a lesser-known Matrix Reloaded trivia right there. Mm.
Oh, I guess when I got upgraded to the specialty extra, I was a crash survivor. I was crash survivor number 3, and like there's a sequence in the crash, you know, chase sequence where like they show for a brief second like some people who are being tended to by paramedics on the side of the road, and I'm one of them, and I'm kind of like holding my head.
Are you credited?
Because I'm not. It's not a speaking
role.
SAG
doesn't apply.
Right, and the director was like, "Oh, make sure you only emote one emotion because non-union extras can't emote more than one emotion."
Now that is a great. Oh my God!
So I'm only emoting
Hollywood rules.
Pain.
So, it's funny to think about the fact that Matrix Reloaded came out in 2002. Because when it came out, or was it 2003? I'm pretty sure it was.
Reloaded was 2002.
Okay.
Revolutions was 2003.
I filmed it in 2001. So it makes
they filmed back to back.
They were filmed back to back.
Yeah. So when it came out,
it might have been 2003 early.
I think it might have been like April and July.
That the summer. I remember it came out in the summer because I was literally just out of school.
Yeah. No, I think it was like June and August actually.
Yeah. I remember I was out of work, so it would have been 2002.
So Matrix Reloaded, it comes out in 2002. It's funny to think about the shoe being on the foot a little – on the other foot a little bit, because when the original Matrix came out in 99, it was totally overshadowed by Phantom Menace and then subsequently like surged past it. In 2002, the Matrix was the biggest thing going. I mean, people were – at least I was incredibly pumped for
pre-release,
the Matrix.
Yeah.
It was a huge deal.
Huge hype because – yeah.
The hype was insane for it. People were talking about the freeway chase scene.
The burly brawl.
And the Attack of the Clones was that same summer. And everybody was basically like, oh, can George Lucas manage to save this sinking ship? Like, what the heck? Okay. Phantom Menace was a bust.
Those were the same summer.
I do want to say, so no one attacks us in the comments. Both movies came out in 2003.
Yeah.
The first one was in May. The second one was in November.
Okay.
So,
and also – May
2003. Yeah. 2003.
My birth, my 21st birthday.
It was a year after Star Wars.
But okay.
Well,
there goes my entire point.
Well, but okay, Attack of the Clones had been disappointing. Just
yes.
For sure. Right. To remind you, like I camped out 4 days for Phantom Menace, and then I lived here in San Francisco, and I went to go see the first screening. There was no midnight screening. It was like a 10 a.m. screening of Attack of the Clones, and people were laughing at it. When Padme and Anakin were rolling around in the fucking flowers, people were laughing at it.
Really?
What about the Yoda man?
Oh, I mean, in Attack of the Clones.
Oh, Attack of the Clones.
Oh, yeah,
but like,
sure.
I remember thinking how quickly we all turned. So, Matrix, you know, a year
Reloaded.
Later, Matrix Reloaded comes out, and again, like, I'm watching it opening day, and people are not loving it the way they loved the Matrix.
Mm, I don't
not
remember.
Quite the, not quite the same.
I remember everybody came out being like, "What? There's a cliffhanger." It's like Back to the Future 2?
Well, you knew there were going to be 2 movies.
Yeah,
though,
I thought everyone knew that.
Yeah, you shouldn't be shocked.
Yeah, but well, okay, so the cliffhanger ends with suddenly Keanu or Neo can control the real world as well. And people are like, wait a minute, there's a matrix within a matrix?
Well, he becomes all powerful basically at the end of the
No, it's actually something to do with like something that's connected to the matrix. He still has power over it, but
that was
else,
the theory was like doesn't... they were like, oh my
yeah,
god,
like,
are they doing a matrix,
matrix
within a matrix?
Right. This was 10 years before Inception. It's crazy.
Yeah, but people were annoyed by that idea.
Yeah, I think people were like willing to take a wait and see approach after Reloaded because it was kind of not what people were expecting, but it still had a lot of cool stuff. So they were like So let's see how it ends.
Reloaded and Revolutions were within a few months?
Yeah. It was like 6 months apart.
Because yeah, May and November.
In my memory, it's like they're like ages apart.
No, they were the same year.
Time moves slower back then.
Yeah. So like, yeah, that was a very eventful summer for me. I remember because I was out of work. I saw the Matrix Reloaded a morning viewing, like a morning screening, because I was out of work on opening day. I was like, I might as well go. So I went and saw it. I was like, I don't know. A couple of months later, I got a job at 1UP.com,
never
which
wasn't
named yet, and moved to California. And then a couple of months after that, The Matrix Reloaded came out. So I went to see it at the Metreon with all my coworkers on opening day and was like, oh, this was not good. But it's kind of weird because I was in like two very different places in life when this movie came out. So it's very embedded in my brain.
I never saw the sequels ever. I was way more of a snob then than I am now.
Wow.
But I just thought the first movie ended with such a great like open-ended mic drop sort of moment where just like, yeah, and he has other adventures and it keeps going on. But I think just like with Star Wars, the more they try to explain the world and add nuance, the worse it gets.
Completely agree.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I think the first movie is just a perfect arc. Interestingly enough, I feel the same way about the original God of War, which God of War 2 and 3 came out. Okay. Didn't really need it. And then they saved it with the new God of War on PlayStation 4.
But don't worry,
4.
The sequel will mess it up.
Well, it's funny because like, I would agree The Matrix is much tighter, obviously the best film of the series. But it does like kind of allude to this much larger mythology, and like 2 and 3 kind of indulge in that to both their detriment and their success. Like I personally like the Merovingian and I like even the scene with the architect. But like in general, 2 and 3 are just kind of bloated and like – I was close to the project. I worked on it. But at the end of it, I was like, oh, it's like a B-. I don't hate it. It has some good scenes. But like we'll see how this thing ends. But by the time Matrix Revolutions came out, I saw that on opening day as well. And I really had a bad reaction to it, specifically
the first Matrix.
The ending
is mostly set in the Matrix with a few scenes in the real world. The Matrix Revolutions is mostly set in the real world with a few scenes in the Matrix. And I feel like that inversion really hurts it. Like – The real world is not interesting in that universe. It's kind of boring.
And I don't think it has the cultural power the second and third movies that the first one has. I don't see any memes or references or, hey, remember this, remember that.
They really wanted to create like a universe with this story. I mean, you have the games that we're going to talk about shortly and the Animatrix. Like all these were built in tandem to the sequel
when
movies.
I think about this, the Reloaded, I often think about the twins because they were on set with us a lot because they weren't known people and they were like we saw them all the time. And like in the final film, I was like, oh, they don't really work. It doesn't really work.
Yeah, the twins are the one reference point I think has lasted. But even then, it's pretty rare to see a reference to those guys.
But for me, they weren't effective. Like I wasn't scared and I wasn't impressed.
I wanted to like The Matrix Reloaded, so when I came out of it, I was going, "Yeah, that was good." Yeah, because
there were some interesting ideas, like the, you know, what happened to Agent Smith after Neo blew him up at the end of the first Matrix, like how he kind of his code combined with Neo's essence, and he grew into something much more powerful than he was ever intended to be and could even venture into the real world. Like all of that was really interesting. But then there was all this stuff like, hey, a whole bunch of machines are attacking a city full of smelly people with porridge.
Who like to have orgies.
Yeah, but can you imagine how bad that orgy smelled? Good God.
Oh, no.
Like, there's no fresh water in this world. Gross. No, thank you.
Well, this is when they were also putting together the big transmedia property as well.
Right.
And we'll probably get into that a little bit because the Enter the Matrix came out at about the same time.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and like there's some of the characters in Matrix Reloaded are like barely featured, and then they're the protagonists of the game. And
let's talk about Enter the Matrix. For EGM?
I reviewed Enter the Matrix.
Even though
for EGM.
You were in the movie?
He had
Where
entered
is the
Matrix.
Journalist integrity?
Well, collusion.
So I worked for EGM at the time, and we had a cover story on it, and we had the exclusive review. And that exclusive review still somehow meant we had to review retail copies of the game, and we had to like pay a lot of money in order to like turn our magazine in late. And I still remember to this day finishing, trying to finish the retail release of the Nintendo GameCube Enter the Matrix and getting several blue screens of death, including one on the final level of the game. Oof. It is a shit show. I mean, come on.
I think it was then that from the like regular gamer perspective that we realized like shiny probably isn't that great. Like I think we realized like it was Messiah was before that and Earthworm Jim was like a fun if really
we were still thinking about Earthworm Jim.
But like Enter the Matrix is like bizarre. It's like four different engines and different types of gameplay and it's just like clearly unfinished.
The shiny refers to polishing a turd.
Yes.
So this game was developed by Shiny Entertainment, formerly of Earthworm Jim.
But like now, no one even probably knows who that is anymore.
Run by Dave Perry,
not Doug.
People know who Dave Perry is.
So I will I will come out in defense of Bob here. He got a lot of crap from people for referring to Dave Perry as Doug Perry. But Doug Perry was a games journalist who was very active, visible
from IGN
same time that Shiny was a force in gaming. It's a totally natural, normal mistake. Let it go, people.
A tale of two Perrys.
Anyway,
if you
will. Two Perrys. Yes, none of them were platypuses.
But I will say, even at the time we were there, Jeremy, it wasn't like Shiny
wasn't in the games press yet.
Okay, well,
it was a few months before I got in the games press.
Post Messiah, Shiny was no longer AAA. I mean, like it wasn't like you just hired.
They didn't even get to do their own sequel to MDT.
Right,
MDK.
Right.
It wasn't BioWare did that.
It wasn't like you hired Miyamoto to make the Matrix game.
I think Messiah was the last chance where they, if you were alive at the time, they talked real big about that game.
Yeah, I remember the Next Gen magazine cover. Like, I'm Jesus for video games, and then they reviewed it and were like, actually, no.
I mean, the Enter the Matrix was a unique idea in that it was like a story that helped flesh out the story between the first Matrix film and the second film. And
Stars Jada Pinkett Smith's character,
which
Niobe.
Is funny because Will Smith being in the original Matrix.
Whoa.
And
mind blown.
And some other guy who is also in the second film who I don't remember.
Well, they show up in Matrix Reloaded and are basically like, hi, folks, we're going on to our other adventure over here. Please buy the video game.
I remember neither the name of the actor nor the character who else you could play as besides her. But yeah.
I have it written down. Hang on.
And didn't they introduce it in the Animatrix?
Perhaps. Well,
Flight of the Osiris.
Ghost was the other character. Very memorable name.
Who portrayed him?
I did not write that down because I don't care.
Yeah, well, he's an actor.
So yes, he is an actor acting as a character.
Cat brought up the Animatrix, which is probably better than the Enter the Matrix.
I recognize the Animatrix. Yeah.
Enter the Matrix directly follows on Final Flight of the Osiris from the Animatrix, which was directed and produced by Squaresoft's movie studio.
Oh, the Hawaii one?
Yes, the only thing they produced other than The Spirits Within.
Wow.
Holy shit.
And the Final Flight of the Osiris was really good.
I need to rewatch Animatrix.
So basically, the Osiris is a ship that's trying to deliver a package. It's destroyed, but Niobe's ship, the Logos, picks up the package and delivers it. And then they do a bunch of stuff kind of behind the scenes of the movies. So stuff that happens in the movies is made possible by Niobe and Ghost in the game. But you don't need to know any of this to watch the movie. It's just like, there's people helping out. Okay.
So Enter the Matrix is like mainly a clumsy third-person action game with some bad driving sequences and some bad like flying sequences.
case study in a developer trying to do too much.
Yeah, but it's like very unfinished.
Our friend Mark McDonald in his review in Electronic Gaming Monthly posited that the game was rushed to market to hit the Matrix Reloaded's release date because they were released simultaneously.
Oh yeah, and I'm pretty sure I gave it a 3.5, and I think that like everybody was very very upset with our reviews because we had the exclusive reviews.
I know I read those reviews when they were live.
It got a ton of hype.
It did.
I mean,
it was a big deal. A lot of money went into this. The Wachowskis were very heavily involved in the production and creation of this game. It was not a small it was meant to be. You know, a transmedia property, you know, like video games and movies, they're the same. Like they can't exist without each other.
And this was
a novel
idea.
And that's very thematically appropriate for The Matrix. But
That was a novel idea in 2003. Well, yeah. I mean, because we were only just starting to come around to the notion of games
polymorphic
on that
this
level.
Was years before the compilation of Final Fantasy VII. And, like, you know, I think
was before the Mana series and the polymorphic content.
I think it's proven that, like, oh, you can want to do five things at once in different media, but it's very hard to make them all good. Animatrix, was there one by Masamune Shiro, or am I making that up?
I believe you made that up, okay. But there was
there's some great – there were definitely some great
like
Japanese
Like two or three
directors.
Of them are good.
Yeah. Shinichiro Watanabe, Bebop guy, right?
The second Renaissance is the one that always stands in my mind. The one that was done by Production IG.
Is that the – basically like here's the backstory.
Yes.
I that's my least favorite one.
Really?
I love the one that's like, you know, the kids finding the glitch in the Matrix.
Oh, that one's good.
Yeah. I mean, that's really good.
That's very Satoshi Kon to me.
Yes. That one is excellent. But the second Renaissance always stood out to me because, first of all, it's beautifully animated.
It is.
And second of all, they do such a great job of realizing the horror of these robots from the very start. There's a lot of really graphic and intense imagery. Mm. Like the bits where the robot's on trial and you're seeing how he's killed his family and then it's subsequently executed. And then later on when they're actually going to war with the robots.
Yeah, I mean, I can't watch those Boston Dynamics videos of people beating the shit out of like primitive robots without thinking, oh my God, did these people not watch the Animatrix? What are they doing?
Guys,
you idiots. Yeah.
But no, it was really intense, and it still stands in my memory to this day.
I will say the Animatrix was well received. Better received than The Matrix or Revolutions or Reloaded, really.
It's funny because Bob's doing Futurama and What a Cartoon, a free plug for you.
Oh, thank
and
you.
This was the DVD era, The Matrix really, like, it was big, but the
DVD. The Matrix
DVDs,
was the first DVD to sell more than a million
That's
units.
True. When the PlayStation 3 came out, the thing you bought with it was The Matrix.
I was going to say, like.
I mean, the PlayStation 2 was. According to Ken Kutaragi, just like jacking into the Matrix.
Oh, sure. It really was. When I was in college in the early 2000s, that was like everyone had Fight Club and The Matrix on DVD. And when you go to like Best Buy to see like, oh, what is DVD? What is this new technology? It would be like them showing The Matrix with like seven speakers around the TV.
And
it
this was and like 2002, 2003 is when everybody was starting to buy TV show DVDs. And here we are with the Animatrix, and it coming out on straight to DVD was a big freaking deal, if I recall correctly. At least it was to me.
Well, and I'll say, actually, it was pivotal in this cachet of like Western producers getting Japanese talent to make something that's actually good. That's, you know, that was pretty new.
I mean, well, anime was very much on the up at that time because Adult Swim was firmly ensconced at this moment.
Well, as you bring up anime, I mean, you know, we've kind of skirted around to Matrix Revolutions, but I want to get to what I really, really, really fucking hate about that film, and it's the last reel. It's when suddenly Neo and Agent Smith are just Dragon Ball Z shooting giant kaiju fucking fireballs at one another. It's a disastrous ending.
It totally
is. it gets even worse in The Path of Neo. The Path of Neo is a really interesting game because they basically – Shiny took
– Is it a sequel?
The Path of Neo is
you're just Neo.
It is basically a retelling of Neo's saga through the Matrix.
Oh,
starting with the first game,
really,
and going all the, or the first movie,
wait,
and going
pause.
All the way through Revolutions.
Don't people think this game is good? Ostensibly,
it's good it's better than the other one, right?
They were like, they did a better job of it than.
And who made it? Was it Shiny?
Shiny, yeah.
Oh. It was a reaction to people saying, "Well, I want to be Neo and enter the Matrix."
Yeah, I don't want to be Niobe.
Well, you know, I lived in the gaming industry when this came out, but because Enter the Matrix was so bad. I like blacked this whole thing out. Like I never played it. I never touched it.
When the game came out, the first thing I saw of it was someone was like, hey, I recorded the ending. Watch this. That's the only thing you care about. So the Path of Neo is really interesting because it's basically like a retelling of the Matrix through Neo's perspective. But there are branching story paths where you can explore alternate outcomes.
Huh.
So if you are playing as Neo and – you know, Morpheus is like, hey, I sent you a FedEx package. Go and stand on the balcony and escape. You can actually follow that all the way through instead of being like, no way, no way. And so like if that happens, then the story advances a little bit differently. It eventually converges with the main storyline.
Huh.
But it plays out differently.
Interesting.
But the final part of it, the Wachowskis actually come out as like Atari 2600 character.
What?
And they start talking to you and they're like, hey, you know, some people didn't like the way the movie ended. They thought I was a downer. So here's an alternate happy ending. And you play as Neo fighting Agent Smith as like a kaiju. He basically is like the entire city that comes to life and the buildings form a giant Agent Smith and you destroy the hell out of a giant Agent Smith.
This is something I looked up on YouTube when YouTube was new. Like, I have to see this ending I've heard about.
Yes, this happened right around the time that YouTube launched. So people were like,
wow.
And gamevideos.com.
Maybe I should revisit The Path of the Neo.
It's kind of weird. It's still a buggy game and kind of messy, but it does play better than Enter the Matrix. You wouldn't probably have as many blue screens. Yeah, the Wachowskis were heavily involved with it. They actually kind of were like, yeah, people didn't really like the way we did the movies, so here's a fun way to do something different.
And that would have been right around the time that they were starting to work on Speed Racer and that kind of thing as well.
Which is really good.
Yeah, well, I've heard that. Everybody was down on Speed Racer when it came out, and now everybody's like, no, Speed Racer's awesome.
It's gorgeous.
Didn't they also do Jupiter Ascending or whatever that was?
They did.
Was that good?
No.
Not as good as
Speed Racer. It has fans. Not me.
Just like Matrix Reloaded and Matrix Revolutions.
I think Speed Racer is their second best film.
No, I totally agree. Speed Racer.
Watch Bound as well. With Jennifer Tilly, whose voice is amazing.
It's amazing to me that there's so many video games because, I mean, there's Enter the Matrix and then Path of Neo and then the MMO also launched.
Right, well, it's
the Matrix Online.
The Matrix Online, which Sega published.
Originally, it was going to be Ubisoft, but then Ubisoft was like, actually, MMOs are losing a lot of money, so let's not.
Didn't they try to do their own, like, the agent or whatever, the agency? Like, somebody had a Matrix-style MMO that never took off.
A game called The Agency. I think that was...
It never actually got released,
Agent. That was Rockstar.
Okay. Oh, it was Rockstar.
Interesting.
So, when it came out, I think this was around the time that EverQuest had exploded and totally made it big. And so everybody wanted to make an MMO around a major media property. Star Wars Galaxies came out. And Enter the Matrix was their answer to that. It's interesting. Once again, Matrix is kind of entwined with Star Wars.
It's interesting that the Enter Matrix was like a sequel to the films.
Which
one? Was it? I mean, the Matrix Online.
The Matrix Online was a sequel to the films. It took place after the big reckoning between Neo and the machines, and they were like, oops, sorry for killing your Jesus. And the premise was basically like humans had basically all been dumped out of the Matrix, and there was the red pill contingent that wanted to keep it that way and the blue pill contingent that wanted to get back into the Matrix, and then there was the Merovingian contingent that was just like doing whatever. And it's kind of interesting because they took, you know, kind of like standard MMO RPG concepts like Spellcaster and Forger and Warrior and turn them into kind of like Matrix-inspired things where you're distorting the Matrix and using, you know, Neo-like powers. And I never played the game, but I actually kind of followed its storyline as it evolved.
Did anyone here play it?
No, I don't think so.
I remember I was just starting to cover video games when it was shutting down in 2009.
No, I actually followed it as it was happening because it was interesting because there was a lot of wheel spinning because you have to do that with MMOs, but they were all very obsessed with finding like fragments
of
Neo's essence in the Matrix.
What year was this, 2005?
2005,
it was 2005 to 2009.
But it was – okay, I remember because when Sega announced it, it was at E3. And
so this was 2 years after Star Wars Galaxies and a year after World of Warcraft.
Yeah, the misfortune to be developed during World of Warcraft's development,
I just remember like when it got announced, it was like weird and like – The Matrix wasn't so cool anymore.
Right, but they actually were like doing stuff with the narrative of the Matrix to the point that like the big thing that happened, and they never really managed to top this or gather more news headlines than when this happened, but they killed Morpheus. Like Morpheus died in an attack. Like the character died.
You can watch videos of this too, of it happening.
It was kind of a big deal. And like that was kind of the last time you really saw the Matrix Online in headlines. That was like 2006. But when it happened, people were like, whoa, that's wild. And so there were a lot of story that
– Whoa. I know Morpheus is dead.
I feel like they tried. But at the end, when they killed it, they were like – according to Wikipedia, maybe? I can't remember where I read this. There were like 500 active participants playing the game at the time. So not that great. I think Giant Bomb.
Yeah, they covered the end covered of it very
their,
well.
Their article was called Not Like This. So that's
yeah, cool. And I think they were like doing videos of being the last people online when it closed down.
Yep.
The closure of MMOs is always an interesting time, you know.
Yeah. Some apocalyptic.
I wonder if there are like traffic.
I wonder if there are like private servers of this, like there are of every closed MMO. Oh, there are. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I was just reading on Waypoint from like circa 2016 or so about somebody who basically had a private server going with Matrix Online because there's nostalgia for everything, apparently.
You know, it's funny. So in this last year, about a year ago, there was the announcement that maybe Warner was going to make a new Matrix film without the Wachowskis, and that was kind of met with strange, you know, disdain. And then a few months ago when we were recording, it was announced that it's moving forward with the Wachowskis. And
no, just Lana Wachowski.
Just Lana. Okay, one of the Wachowskis. But for me, I was weirdly excited. And like – now, after doing this podcast and revisiting the first film, like I am kind of like open, more open to it than I thought I was.
I want to see where they're going with this because they pretty definitively killed off Trinity and Neo in the Revolutions.
Well, and when this rumor first hit last year, it was going to be a reboot, which I thought was actually maybe a better idea. But now it's apparently a sequel, so we'll see what happens with it. But like part of me is like I felt like because the Matrix games that I played, well, the one that I played was so shitty, I never played a good Matrix game. And I feel like wouldn't it be cool if one day there was a good Matrix game?
I think now the industry is better situated to do something like that because, you know, if Shiny were around today to make a Matrix game, they would not create their own buggy, janky-ass engine. They would just license Unreal Engine 4. They would have a steady, stable bedrock of technology to work from, and it would be fine. Like they wouldn't have to deal with all those issues. They could actually just focus on game design. And I think, you know, they would be more open to outsourcing. They'd be able to bring in more talent to get things done. Even if they had to hit a deadline, they would just make a better game. I think the industry is better geared to this
sort of thing. We're seeing something similar happening right now with Jedi Fallen Order where the movie is about to come out as of the recording of this podcast. Apologies for dating this podcast,
The Last Skywalker.
By the way. And
The Rise of Skywalker.
Jedi Fallen Order is going to be coming out right around that same time. And yeah, it's in a different time period, but more or less like it's supposed to be like
– It's definitely like skating on the skirts of Star Wars hype.
The expanded universe as it were. By
also,
the way
– The Mandalorian coming out as well.
I have a correction for angry people who are going to yell at me. When the Matrix Online shut down, they lost the source code.
Oh.
So there are no private servers.
The irony. The irony.
Unlike Meridian 59, where you can still play on a private server.
Yeah. But somebody was going out and trying to recreate the Matrix Online through Unreal Engine 4.
Wacky.
Because –
I mean, the Matrix Online was mostly about trying to find like the code for, you know, Neo's fragments or whatever. So.
Like, I still feel like the Matrix IP could be well served as like a really flashy like – belt brawler, like platinum games developed, like beat 'em up.
Come on.
I like it.
I want like a Second Life kind of, you know, Shenmue sort of thing where you're like living in the Matrix and learning to, you know, bend its reality.
Oh, come on. You don't think like Neo and Trinity fighting in like an Aliens versus Predator Capcom kind of experience could work?
That's so mundane and limited though.
Actually, we didn't mention the influences too much, but Platinum Games could not exist without the Matrix because every one of their games
has
bullet time in it. I don't know if the new – whatever that Switch game was called, I didn't play it.
Astral Chain?
Does that have like bullet time
sure
style
mechanics?
There's
like, bullet time,
mechanics?
There's Witch Time, there's Bullet Witch, which was another
I guess you're right, Bob. Like bullet time is the real thing.
Yeah, Max Payne. I mean,
Max Payne,
every game now, like after the Matrix, every game has a slowdown mechanic.
Yeah, the legacy of the Matrix is
even
bullet time.
BioWare games, like, you know, starting with KOTOR, you would be able to basically pull up a menu in real time and everything would slow down or stop while you kind of performed an action.
Yeah.
You still see it to this day.
Hugely influential.
Yeah. I mean, to some extent, it was really overdone right after the Matrix, but movie makers still use it. It's not a discredited function.
Yeah, it's like Zack Snyder where it's like slow, fast, slow, fast, slow, fast.
Yeah, right. What was that stupid like barnyard kung fu movie?
Oh, Kung Pao Enter the Fist?
Kung Pao Enter the Fist.
Yeah, I mean, 99 and 2002 was like just the dreck of Matrix parodies. Shrek had one.
Yes.
Like everybody was doing like, what if Bullet Time, but this?
What if Bullet Time, but extremely bad and stupid?
Oh, well.
I would like if there were to be a new Matrix game, I would like them to explore the meta aspects of doing a video game about effectively being in a video game. Mm. So I think what was the horror game that came out on the GameCube? Eternal Darkness. Like, think about like that.
Like Insanity Effects and all that.
Yeah, where they're kind of messing around with you and making you feel as if like the world around you is actually the Matrix. Like, if they could pull that off, that could be at least worthwhile.
I think the Matrix game I would like would be a JRPG 2D chibi SD.
If we're talking about the future of the Matrix, my honest belief is that I wonder if this idea could possibly appeal to anybody not living in 1999. Like, I feel like it was the perfect time for this movie, and just the state of the world and our thought patterns has changed so much. I just don't know if this is still appealing to people.
It's true. You can't – like, modern young people don't understand what it is to like unplug from a world where you're not 24/7 online being judged by millions of, you know, like people.
Already saw Matrix 4. It was called Ralph Breaks the Internet.
Exactly. And it's okay, like anyway. This was very much of the X-Files 90s world where it's just like we don't have problems. So like what about conspiracies? But it's like now the conspiracies are open and nobody cares about them. We know everything about everything. So it's like I just don't know if this kind of idea is appealing now. That's why I feel like this is a real pre-9/11 movie.
And being jacked in doesn't have the same appeal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's even like, the term jacked in is
I need
so
a
old.
Break from the internet.
But the truth is you can't – literally cannot disconnect as a normal American.
No.
I would like to red pill from Twitter.
Your job won't let you disconnect.
Yep.
We have the Matrix has us as we speak. It's too late.
All right. Well, anyway, everyone, I would like to say thank you for the messages you've submitted through the Matrix to let us know what you think about the Matrix. Unfortunately, we don't have time to read those, but we will have a mailbag episode where we touch on all the cool listener submission emails that we've received. So that's rad. But I think we are done now. It's late and we're all sleepy and ready to red pill ourselves away from this podcast. But yeah, it's been a good conversation. And I think Bob is right. I think, you know, like The Matrix happened in 1999 and that was the time for it, and now the world is different, heavily influenced by The Matrix in a lot of ways, and there's no escaping it. But if you are okay with that, then you can continue to stay jacked into Retronauts and listen to us on a weekly basis, more than weekly actually, at retronauts.com and on iTunes and so on and so forth. And you can support us through Patreon if you would like to hear more conversations about classic games and classic movies and the intersection between such. That's patreon.com/retronauts. Anyway, guys and ladies, please let's talk about where the internet can find you. What is the URL to which you can be accessed by your fellow travelers in the Matrix?
You can find me on Twitter at ShaneWatch, all one word, ShaneWatch.
You can find me on Twitter at @_capod. Also, I have a podcast. It's called Axe of the Blood God. It's US Gamers RPG podcast. I don't know when this episode's coming out, but we're in the middle, as of the recording of this, of console RPG Quest. We just did the Sega Saturn, which is
I bet
great.
There's a lot of good stuff there.
Was there an episode on Linkle Liver Story?
Yes, we bring that
Shit.
One up.
Shit.
Yes.
I got to download that.
Yeah. We had John Linneman from Digital Foundry on.
Oh, nice.
And John Linneman is...
We need to get him on here.
...is right up there with Jeremy in terms of collecting, so...
Linkle Liver Story has the best 3D tree on Saturn.
There you Ooh. Go. So download Axe of the Blood God and listen to that one.
Shots fired by 3D trees. Hey, it's Bob Mackey. Find me on Twitter as Bob Servo. And if you want to go back to 1999, check out all my other podcasts, Talking Simpsons and What a Cartoon. Go to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons or find them wherever you find podcasts. Right now we're doing Simpsons Season 10 and Talking Futurama Season 2, both taking place in 1999. So if you want to transport yourself back into 1999 by what was being made fun of and tackled, the subjects being tackled, check it out at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons.
I thought you were going to have a podcast you recorded in 1999.
I can't make that happen. No.
And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Twitter as GameSpite and on YouTube under my own name, Jeremy Parrish. I will take you back to 1998 to the Game Boy Colors launch. How's that for exciting? Yes, that's right. Anyway, we're done here. We're logging out.
Wait, T-Frog, what's the most recent book I can buy from T-Frog's books?
I didn't actually get to do one this year. So my most recent books have been Game Boy Works 1 and 2.
Next year.
All right. Thanks, everyone. And we will see you on virtual space sometime, avoiding meat space at all costs.